For those of you who are visitors, we're working our way through the book of Job in our studies these days. I might terrify you by saying we're looking at chapters 22, 23, and 24 today, but I'll calm your nerves. I'm not looking at every verse and comma. We're going to take the broad themes of these three chapters to catch something of a glimpse of them. I'm going to read from chapter 23, which is the start of Job's reply to Eliphaz. So the whole of chapter 23 of Job, our reading this morning from God's word. Then Job replied, "Even today my complaint is bitter. His hand is heavy in spite of my groaning. If only I knew where to find him. If only I could go to his dwelling. I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I'd find out what he would answer me and consider what he would say. Would he oppose me with great power? No, he would not press charges against me. There, an upright man could present his case before him and I'd be delivered forever from my judge. But if I go to the east, he is not there. If I go to the west, I do not find him. When he's at work in the north, I do not see him. When he turns to the south, I catch no glimpse of him. But he knows the way that I take. When he has tested me, I will come forth as gold. My feet have closely followed his steps. I've kept to his way without turning aside. I have not departed from the commands of his lips. I've treasured the words of his mouth more than my daily bread. But he stands alone, and who can oppose him? He does whatever he pleases. He carries out his decree against me, and many such plans he still has in store. That is why I'm terrified before him. When I think of all this, I fear him. God has made my heart faint. The Almighty has terrified me. Yet I am not silenced by the darkness, by the thick darkness that covers my face." Don't know if you feel comfortable talking to God or about God like that, but here's a man who's in a real relationship with God and is, as we said last Sunday, struggling enormously to handle all that's happening to him at that stage in his life. Well, Job's chapter 22 to 34 this morning. To set your minds on a constant theme throughout the rest of the morning, I've taken one verse out of chapter 23, and it's on the screen there for you. "When he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold." We said last week there are some parts of Job that have these absolutely brilliant little kernels of truth that are shafts of light in otherwise a very dark place. Last week we had none of them. We just had to face the fact that there are periods of life, there are situations in life when God's people struggle and they struggle and they struggle some more, and there's no immediate brightness for them. Today, amongst Job's struggles, we have that little bit of light to look forward to before we're finished this morning. I guess that many of us have heard or asked somebody, "What's your secret formula?" Somebody reaches 100 years of age and the TV cameras come along. "What's your secret formula for reaching 100 years of age?" Or some athlete or competitor wins gold medal prize and someone will ask them sooner or later, what was your secret formula? How did you do it?" Or someone has managed to stay married for 50 years and the crowds flock along to Mary Livingstone next week and say, "Mary, what was the secret formula?" Sticking with David that length of time. Sorry, David. We do congratulate you both and hope you have a happy 50th to come. Start off today's thought then with Eliphaz's formula. Eliphaz starts to speak in chapter 22, and a bit like his other two chats with Job, he has the perfect answer for Job, as he thinks. And it comes in a formula. Here's what you do, Job. You do A, you do B, and you do C, and everything's going to be fine for you. They come under the headings of admit something, submit to something, and you'll prosper. And I want to flick through those very quickly this morning, because sadly, they're so typical of exactly what Eliphaz has said before. It's just taken another degree ahead. The first line is, you've got to admit that you're wicked. You are a wicked man, Job. If you go back in your minds, in the kind of talks that Eliphaz's mates had with Job, and to start off simply saying, we believe you're a godly man, and we don't understand why you're suffering. They just sat with him in his suffering. Then they started to say, well, Job, there must be some wee thing that's gone wrong in your life. There's something that's displeasing God, and that's why this is happening. Next stage was, Job, you must be a really bad person because you're suffering so much. And then we turn through chapter 22, see how far Eliphaz, one of Job's best friends, is prepared to go to try and find out what it is that Job must have done. There's a list of things in chapter 22. Verse 5, is not your wickedness great? Verse 6, he starts to put some flesh on those bones. You took everyday clothing as security. In those days, if somebody was in desperation, needed a temporary loan, there was no Ulster Bank to go to get confused by. And so you went to your mate and you said, here you are, I'll give you this as a security and I'll pay you back and get that item back again. And God's law forbade people taking as security the basic essentials of life, like their own clothing. And that's precisely here what Eliphaz says, Job, that's what you did. Your brothers came looking for help, and you took their basic clothing as security against their debt. Verse 7, he says to Job, you refused food and water to travelers. Again, it's a kind of basic law of the Eastern world, still is, that if someone is traveling a long distance across the desert, through the wilderness, and arrives at your house and they are starving with hunger, parched with thirst, that the very least you do is give them water to drink and the basic essentials of food to live. It isn't a question of giving them a 5-star meal. It's simply saying this is somebody in desperation. You feed them and water them. Yet Eliphaz says, Job, I know what your wickedness is. And you've actually held back food and water from those who are in desperation. Verse 9, you ignored the widows and orphans in need. Again, it's true in our society. If you want to start a charity that gathers momentum quickly, make it for orphans. Maybe widows slightly less so in our social security state, but a bit there still. There's a natural human empathy with people who are orphans and widows. Written into the code of behavior in almost every culture is that if there's no security system provided, then widows and orphans get looked after. Eliphaz says, you, Job, are so wicked, you didn't help the widows and the orphans. And by the time we get down to verse 13, he's really adding to his list of wickedness that Job's committed, as you've actually tried to hide all this evil from God. You think that you can pretend you're a righteous, godly, good man, and underneath you're a class one sinner. You listen to your best friend talking like that, and you wonder what's going on. Particularly because there's absolutely no evidence for anything that Eliphaz has just said. It's a mere fabrication. Eliphaz has a formula in his mind, and stage one of his formula is you admit to God that you have done wicked things. He doesn't know what Job has done. There is no record of them. So Eliphaz concocts them. And he suggests the very worst possible sins, the base evils in society, and says, Job, come on, admit to them, confess them. Here's the stage one to prosperity. Just admit it, just confess it. Doesn't matter whether you actually did it or not, Job. And he must have known that Job wouldn't have done those things. It was God's testimony of Job right at the very beginning to Satan. This is the most upright man in the whole world. And yet his friend, so keen to get this formula working, is prepared to say the worst things about his friend and say, come on, get to stage one of this formula. Admit that what you've done is wrong. Second part of his formula is submit to God. It's there in chapter 22 and verse 21. Submit to God and be at peace with him. In this formula, admit you've done something wrong and then say, God, I want you to be my master. I want you to be my leader. I want you to be my king. You're my Lord. You're in charge of my life. I submit myself to you. In other words, up to now, God, I've been rebelling against you. I've been fighting against you. I've been at war with you. But now I'm going to quit. I'm going to accept that you're right in punishing me, and I'm going to accept your way in the future. It's part two of the formula. We know from everything that Job has been crying out from his heart in the past that he's absolutely submitted to God. If only he knew what God was doing, there'd be no problem. Job's problem was not that he was fighting against God. He was just trying to understand God and comprehend difficult things. But Eliphaz needs his formula worked. Admit something's wrong, Job. Submit to God. And then thirdly, God will prosper you. But tail end of verse 21. In this way, prosperity will come to you. And you can just see suddenly how this formula works. A plus B equals C. Admit you're wrong, submit to God, and you'll have prosperity. We have to say that's never an acceptable motivation for seeking God. It's never a true acknowledgement of who God is and what God wants from us to say, well, my motivation for coming to faith or returning to God or seeking God or submitting to God or following God, you know, my motivation is if I do this, I'll get prosperous, I'll enjoy prosperity. That's exactly how Satan himself had misinterpreted the godly life right at the beginning of this book. Remember, he came to God and God said, have you ever thought of Job, my servant? Not a man on earth like him. And Satan's immediate response was, he's only doing it because you're good to him. You've put a hedge around him. You've blessed him. He's one of the wealthiest men on earth. He's one of the most prosperous people on earth. If you took that away from him, Job would not love you then. Job doesn't love you because you're God. He loves you because you're good. And here's Eliphaz, one of Job's best mates, who's actually saying the same kind of thing. Here's a great formula. Confess your sin, submit to God, and you'll be prosperous. And it simply isn't true. And anyone who comes to God on that kind of spiritual formula approach will find it's not a genuine turning to God, and it doesn't often last. Spiritual formulas like this should always raise our suspicions. I think formulas are brilliant in maths and physics and nuclear science, etc., but formulas aren't that great when it comes to relationships or romance. There was a man who reached his 60th wedding anniversary. I think actually the illustration was 50, but didn't want David to get a guilt complex. Reached his 60th wedding anniversary, and he was asked for his formula for having such a happy marriage for such a length of time. And he told the story how all the way through their married life, he and his wife booked a table in a local high-class restaurant every Monday and every Thursday. The highest, best, most expensive meal on the menu was booked. The best bottle of wine was drunk. And the whole evening was spent relaxed in this restaurant. The person was asking the man, I said, well, what did the two of you talk about during those times in the restaurant? And he said, oh, we didn't talk. He says, I went on Mondays and she went on Thursdays. There's no such thing as a formula for a relationship. See, a relationship is about two people interacting. Not just saying, I'll do A and then I'll do B and hey, bingo, C will come out the other end. A relationship is about two people who build a relationship with each other, listening to each other, responding to each other, questioning each other, doubting each other, affirming each other, and that intermix doesn't work by formula. It's a bit like when you did painting by numbers as a child, or an adult maybe. It was never going to be art. It's not saying it's wrong, but painting by numbers doesn't produce fine quality art. And relationships by numbers, by formulas, doesn't work. It might feel like it is for a while. It might look like a good relationship. But relationships depend on two people relating to each other, responding to each other, and that's especially so in the spiritual life. Zophar's formula simply doesn't work. Which leads us to Job's consternation, secondly. And Job starts his reply in chapter 23, and it goes all the way into chapter 24. The guts of it can be summed up in three or four statements that Job is struggling with. He's really upset and concerned about things. And the first of them in verse 3 is that God cannot be found. And this is an absolute statement of Job, because Job has found God in the past. But it's just how things are for him at this point in his life. If only I knew where to find him. If only I could go to his dwelling. I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I'd find out what he would answer me and consider what he would say. And here in Job's darkness, he's saying to Eliphaz, my problem is not that I haven't fed the orphans and the widows, that I haven't cared for the travelers who come through this society, etc., etc. My problem is I'm struggling to get in touch with God at the moment. It's that area of my relationship that is causing me pain and anguish. It's that I'm trying to sort at this point in time. But God, it just feels to me as though God is in hiding. I can't get him to speak to me. And read from verse 3 all the way down to about verse 14. That's the kind of language he's going through. If only he could meet up with God and have a face-to-face with him, it'd be sorted. Verse 15 has a different theme. It's the theme of God being frightening. And it's very strong language. This is why I'm terrified before God. When I think of all this, I fear him. God has made my heart faint. The Almighty has terrified me. When did you ask to say that in your prayers at night before going to bed? A long time, I guess. It's not the kind of language that comes naturally to us who believe in respecting God and reverencing God as we think he ought to be. But here's a man who's being absolutely real in his relationship. If he has a relationship with the living God, and that God doesn't seem to be listening to him, and that God seems to be in hiding somewhere, and that God seems to be increasing the burdens and the difficulties and the pains and the sorrows, then what strikes Job is, this is terrifying for me. I've hardly been able to manage up till now, and if worse is coming, which I think he expects, I'll not survive it. And for him to think of God like that terrifies him inside his own heart and mind. Chapter 24, his third picture of God is that God is frustrating. He has not set a day of reckoning in the here and now. Why does the Almighty not, this is chapter 24, verse 1, why does not the Almighty set times for judgment? Why must those who know him look in vain for such days? Men move boundary stones, they pasture flocks they've stolen, they drive away the orphan's donkey, and he goes down through all the list of things that bad people do. And he says, why doesn't God set a day of judgment in the here and now. We know from what Job has said elsewhere in the book, he utterly, absolutely believes there's a final day of reckoning. That's not in doubt here or anywhere else in the book. His confidence, we saw a couple of Sundays back, that one day I, in my flesh, will stand before God. I will see him and not another. He's confident one day God the judge will do the necessary. But it's in the immediate present that Job is struggling. Why doesn't God set days of justice and righteousness here and now? And God's failure, as he sees it, to do that, is utterly, utterly frustrating for him. And for two reasons. The oppressed people of the world have no current justice. And read chapter 24 all the way down to verse 12. Deal with that. Here's these poor people. They've raised sheep. The robbers come, steal them. And the poor soul is left with no sheep and no justice. People are oppressed. They have bad treatment done against them. The wicked people get away with it. The poor folk who've suffered have no redress, no justice. God hasn't set a day. Why doesn't he do it? Chapter 24, verse 13 through to 24 is the counter side of that. And the result is that the wicked have no current judgment. This argument's been going backwards and forwards between him and his friends. Some say, well, if you do wicked, God will judge you here and now and you'll have a hard time. Job's question was, well, is that fact? Is that reality? Isn't it the reality that bad people do bad stuff and they get away scot-free? That's how he interprets a lot of life. And that's what he's saying here. How frustrating are you, God? Because you won't set little days here and there when you suddenly bring everybody together and call people to account, relieve the burden of the oppressed, deal with the wicked people and sort them out. So here's Job not following a simplistic formula. Here's Job who's in a relationship with God, and his suffering is making that relationship difficult. I don't know all of you in your homes, so this isn't a reference to anybody here this morning consciously, but have you ever fallen out with your wife or your husband for a week and you haven't talked for a whole week, not even one single word? Pretty rare. Maybe for an hour or two, and then you sort it out before you go to bed. Hopefully that's the scriptural injunction. Maybe it's been really, really bad and she didn't make any tea for you, then it's tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon before you start to talk again. But can you imagine a whole week goes by and not a single word between you? You say, what kind of relationship's that? Or your son and daughter fall out with your parents and you've banned them from something or other and they're really furious with you and the lips get zipped, I'm not going to talk to you. And it lasts for how long? Maybe till tea time, maybe till pocket money's needed, maybe till transport to whatever is needed. Sooner or later, the silence gives way. Because however fractious the relationship was, the relationship still exists, is needed, is valued, and communication starts again. Here's Job's problem. Before all this started, God himself reckoned that Job was the best person he had on earth. The relationship Job had with God was brilliant. And now they spent a whole week in silence, him and his friends on the rubbish heap. Then, whatever time it's taken to get to this point in the process, maybe days, maybe weeks, maybe months. And God has been silent. Job has done a one-way conversation with God. That's how it feels like to him. I've been talking to God. I've been asking God questions. I've been shouting at God. And there's just silence. How can I carry on my relationship with a God who's silent with me? Lots of things bother us as Christians. Being a Christian doesn't necessarily become easier as time goes on. And one of the worst things is to feel that God has gone quiet on us. We blame ourselves very often when we go quiet on God and don't talk to him. That's another side of the story. He loves to have us talk to him. But how difficult is it in the Christian life, especially when suddenly there's a whole flood of problems and troubles and sufferings come on us, and we say, oh Lord, please tell me what this is about. Please, Lord, explain this to me. And there's just apparently silence from heaven. And the real hurt is not just that we don't know the answers, but that God seems to have quit the relationship. And you know what you all do then? We all do it. We wonder, well, have I committed the unpardonable sin? Have I failed God in some massive way I didn't even realize I'd done? Have I misunderstood God's plans for me? And am I walking in disobedience to him? Have I got out of touch with God? We go through all this stuff in our heads and hearts. And it symbolizes the longing and the ache we have to have a relationship with God that's ongoing, real, tangible, and precious to us. Now, don't forget, we know why it's happening to Job. Job had felt God move away because God had allowed Job to be tested by Satan to prove that Job would still love God no matter what. And so it's not just the physical suffering, it's not just the mental anguish, but the spiritual sense of being abandoned. And yet still, at the end of the day, Job's faith and trust was in God. Which brings us to our final thought this morning, Job's affirmation. In the middle of all this, when he has tested me, I shall come forth as gold. It is one of those brilliant nuggets of truth that Job has several of in the course of this difficult book. Interesting, it's the first time, we're in chapter 22, 24, first time in the whole book that anyone has ever suggested that what might be going on is God testing him. We've had the idea that God is punishing because he's a wicked, wicked person, or that God is disciplining because he's a child who's gone astray and needs a wee bit of correction. But Job here discovers, as God inspires and leads him, Job discovers there's another possibility, that God tests us at times. Now again, you and I know from the whole course of the book that even that's not quite spot on. More accurately for Job is that God was allowing Satan to test Job. But Job hasn't got that far yet in his thinking. What does suddenly strike Job, and it's only a brief moment here, and you don't find it echoed anywhere else in the rest of the book, but what does strike Job for a minute is here's another interpretation. Not that God is punishing, not that God is chastising, but God is testing. And then he uses this phrase, I'll come forth like gold at the end of the day. And you ask, well, what kind of test might God put on him or us? People test gold to prove its authenticity, to prove it's the real deal. I trust none of you would simply go downtown and pick up a lump of gold-colored stuff and accessorize and say, well, I've got some pure gold here. You'd get it tested if you thought it might be gold to see if it was a real article or not. And testing is a way of proving that something is the real thing. Or again, you might test something to test whether it's durable, whether it will do the job required of it. Will this piece of metal carry the weight that's going to be placed upon it in the future? Will it hold its shape if I design some precious jewelry out of it? So the testing tests the durability of the item concerned. Or if you've hit hard times with the Ulster Bank and you're taking the family jewels down to the pawnbroker tomorrow, the gold will be tested to ascertain its value. What level of purity does it have? Because value will depend upon the purity of the metal concerned. I think all those, and perhaps more, are the reasons why God tests us as people sometimes. tests us to show us that we are the real deal. How do I know if I'm a real Christian? Do I know I'm a real Christian because everything's hunky-dory in life and things going grand? No, I far more know how real a Christian I am when I go through a tough time and discover that all I claimed, all the promises I believed were true, actually work and hold fast in that time. God tests us to show us we can stick the heat. We said lots of times our great fear in the comfort of the Western world is, what would happen if I was a Christian in a situation of great persecution? Would I hold my ground? Would I stay firm? We'll never know until we're in it. Testing proves whether we've got the durability or not. God tests us to show that our faith is of more value than of gold that perishes. There's Peter's words in the New Testament taking up the same idea, that it is the testing in physical and other sufferings that demonstrates this person is pure gold, real faith, genuine faith. And the second aspect of that is God not only tests, but God will bring him forth as gold at the end of the day. And I love this contrast. Eliphaz's formula, remember, was admit you've done something wrong, submit to God, and you will have prosperity. You'll become rich again. You'll have all the flocks you want. You'll have all the farms you want. You'll have all the crops you want. You'll be rich again. What Job is pondering is, when I submit to God and I'm in a relationship with him and he tests me and tries me and pushes me to the limit, not then he'll make me prosper and I'll come forth with gold, but I'll come forth like gold. God's about working on us as people, not in providing us with possessions, bettering who we are rather than necessarily bettering what we have. It's a brilliant discovery by Job. It's not the end of his struggling. Chapter 24 is back to struggling times, mostly all over again. But it is another step of progress. It is in his mind and heart a step of progress and understanding that there are lots and lots and lots of reasons why bad things happen to good people. And amongst them is the testing and trying and proving of genuine gold. But it's also a step of progress in that sense of trust in God with which we finished last week. He's still struggling, still unanswered questions here. And yet here's this long-term view that when he's finished testing, I will come forth as gold. I'll be the better person for all that I've come through. And if Job got that, there's no reason why I shouldn't and you shouldn't. It's not saying I love the pain. It's not saying I love the trials. Bring them on. A few more, please. It is saying that if God determines something is worth suffering and putting me through it, then that same God will bring me forth like gold at the end of the day. He's going to do a job that betters me as a person through what I'm suffering with and going through today. Can you believe that? Can you take your sufferings, your trials, your troubles, your frustrations, your anxieties, your cares, and say, God, I don't understand why this is happening. I can't see all the purpose, but when you finished, I'm going to be the better person that you want me to be. Let's pray together. We don't understand, Father, all that you are doing, and we thank you for that area of uncertainty and ignorance that helps us to put faith and trust completely in you. Thank you that you are a God in whom we can trust. We can rely upon you. You don't make mistakes. And you have a goal in mind that for those who trust you, involves bringing us all out like refined, purified, bright, brilliant, shining gold at the end of the day for your glory. Well, that's what we want. And so afresh, we simply pray, do what it takes in us to refine, test, and purify us and achieve your purpose in our lives. For Jesus' sake, we pray. Amen.